it is remarkably difficult to be effective in today's workplaces. And I want people to give themselves grace and space for that. I think that in and of itself, just kind of admitting we're at like a weird moment in working history goes through cycles, just admitting that we're in a weird moment and strategizing accordingly, I think it's a bit of an unlock.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and we have an amazing guest today who we're bringing back to the show. Her name is Melissa Swift. You can check out our first conversation way back in episode 425, but she is a leading voice on how organizations, teams, and individuals can succeed in an ever more challenging world of work. And she's also the author of Work Here Now, Think Like a Human, and Build a Powerhouse Workplace. Her quarterly columns in MIT Sloan Management Review often rank among their most read articles. She speaks regularly at events, including the MIT CIO Symposium, and her expertise has been featured everywhere. For example, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, NPR, Newsweek, Economist, Washington Post, Axios, and many, many more. She's here with us today to talk about her new book, Effective, How to Do Great Work in a Fast-Changing World, which is available everywhere tomorrow. Melissa Swift, welcome back to the Daily Helping. It is fantastic to have you with us once again.
I am just excited to be back. I had a good time the first time, and I think it'll be a great conversation again.
It's always a testament when people survive and they want to come back. They're not forced to come back. So I'm so excited you're here. Usually we do the superhero origin story, but we did that in 425. So I want to spend a lot of time talking about Effective today. But I am curious, because you're writing all of the time, you're well known for the writing that you do, why did you want to write the book Effective?
It's interesting. I would love to pretend that I had some grand, you know, sort of master plan for this series of books, you know, and it's going to be like the, you know, the fourth wing of business books or whatever, you know, for folks who get that reference. But actually, this book, kind of the concept came to me very organically, which is after my first book, after Work Here Now, I got a lot of the same reaction and same question over and over and over. And people would come to me and they'd say, Melissa, you characterize the world of work pretty aptly. You know, the way you described all the issues, that resonates. I get it. I agree. And I agree with all your suggestions in the first book. But I am just one person. What can I personally do, right? If I want to do a better job at work amidst all this craziness that, you know, that you've kind of thoughtfully described. And so I got obsessed with that question. You know, I once heard, I think this guy was like a, you know, Nobel laureate or something. And he said, I write books about things I want to learn about. And so I got really energized by, you know, not what do I already know about effectiveness, you know, some of that's in the book, but what do I want to learn about how, you know, people actually can kind of break through some of these problems that seem really insurmountable in the working world. So it was, you know, kind of like audience questions was what got me to this book.
And I love that. And I love that, you know, we frame these as books for business, and you're so well known in that space. But the reality is, if we're learning how to be effective, that translates, right? We can be effective spouses, effective partners, effective parents, effective children, right? Like, there's all kinds of ways we get to be effective in the things we do, and it only makes life better for all of those around us. So that's why I'm so excited to talk about this book. So take us through Effectiveness 101, Melissa. Let's start with, you know, how have you structured this book and what is a reader going to get out of it?
So there's kind of two big chunks in the book. First big chunk is what I call the effectiveness architecture. So what actually makes you good at your job? And it's interesting because professionally, I've worked with a million different, you know, I think today we call them skills ontologies, right? So it's like we have 60,000 different skills, you know, that we're looking at and measuring. We have 30,000 different skills. And that's very helpful for companies. But for individual people, I probably lack the bandwidth to go through, you know, let's say 50,000 skills and pick which ones I have and I don't have. And it gets really Byzantine. So the effectiveness architecture is an attempt to kind of stylize and simplify what's going on behind those frameworks into four simple things that help you be good at your job or good at your life or whatever. And those four things are knowledge. So literally, do I have the underlying understanding of what I'm trying to do? Methods. Do I have a great way to kind of put it all together and get it done? People. Am I good with working with people to get things done? And then technology. Am I good with working with technology to get things done? And, you know, it's purposely extremely simple because what I've found in my consulting work is when you start off with kind of a fairly simple framework, what you can do is then explore it in an unbelievable amount of depth. So, you know, let's say we're looking at things like the AI journey right now. There's a ton that you can explore about that simple thing about what does it mean to be good with technology, right? There's a lot of exploration you can put behind that. Whereas if you had 17 different crazy parts in the framework, you wouldn't be able to do, you know, kind of that deep work that actually gets you somewhere.
So we kind of jumped into number four, talking about AI. And in a way, this ties into number one. I want to explore knowledge. But I also, however you answer that and talk about knowledge, I want to address knowledge through the lens of AI, because one of the things AI is really good is putting information together, knowledge. One of the things it's also really good at, in a bad way, is creating knowledge that's totally fake. And so that's a problem. Right. So let's talk about knowledge. Let's do knowledge 101 first, and then we'll dig into the AI thing, because I think they'll connect to each other.
Yeah. So, you know, knowledge is near and dear to my heart because I have on the website, I have like a little self quiz that you can take. But also talk about in the book that in general, you can observe kind of by how other people are reacting to you, which one you're truly good at. But knowledge is the one that I'm good at, right? So this is the one that I talk about with a great deal of personal passion. And the idea is that I think when people say, you know, AI is going to, I mean, I've seen people literally say knowledge has no role in the workplace anymore. Somebody put that on LinkedIn, you know, because of AI, there's no role for knowledge anymore. And I was like, well, I don't want to work at that company, right, where there's no role for knowledge. Because the reality is, to your point, what AI is good at is kind of information assembly. But there are two things about that that I think humans kind of still have the edge and may remain having the edge forever. Number one, and I talk about this in the book, not all knowledge is actually out there and explicit. So when an LLM misses the mark, sometimes it's because there's what's called tacit knowledge, the knowledge that's kind of like locked in the back of people's brains, kind of half known, right? But it's really important. So I'll give you an example. We were on a family trip to Japan. And so we asked one of the LLMs to say, okay, can you recommend a ramen restaurant for us based on kind of these specs? We give it the specs and it recommends it's a really nice place. And we get there and there's a line out the door. Because that ramen restaurant is very well known in explicit knowledge, right? It's well documented and bloggers liked it and they have a special yuzu ramen. And I'm sure it would have been fabulous, but there was a line out the door. So my daughter, you know, her generation is not necessarily as pro AI as mine, as Gen X. Mom, let me just do a Google search. Does a Google search, finds us this, you know, little ramen joint on the second floor. When I say it was one of the best meals I've ever eaten, I mean, it was absolutely phenomenal. And there wasn't a line out the door because it was one of those places that maybe existed a little bit more in tacit knowledge. So that's one kind of critical piece where, you know, humans again kind of have the edge. And then the other piece of knowledge is actually understanding how information interrelates. So an AI is going to put information together kind of mechanically, and it's going to, you know, it's doing the, like, you know, fill in the next word thing, predictive text. So you know, it'll see commonly occurring patterns of how that knowledge is put together. But as humans, we are able to, and particularly if you think about an area where you've built a really great body of knowledge, you put facts together differently than somebody who doesn't have that body of knowledge. So, you know, if you're, let's say, an expert in a particular field, let's say you're a doctor in a particular field, and somebody gives you a list of symptoms, you put that knowledge together differently than me, who might see that set of symptoms and say, yeah, it's just a cold. Whereas somebody deep in that, you know, again, it's gonna, they're gonna assemble the information differently. And that's the power of knowledge. And I think in particular, where you see frustration and pushback on AI sometimes is from people who are very strong in that knowledge vector. Because again, number one, there's so much kind of pressure on knowledge, but number two, because they can see very clearly how the AI is not doing knowledge right.
And so we've got this now disconnect where there's people who are frustrated with AI that hallucinates. And then we have these other group of people, the ones who say knowledge has no place in the workplace anymore, who are like, great, I'm just going to put in a prompt because I'm awesome and I can make great prompts. And then they're just going to accept that as gospel. How do we reconcile that?
Number one, we need usage guidelines. You know, any piece of technology you've ever set up has had at least a little one-page, you know, instruction manual. And we kind of handed AI out without the instruction manual. So some of it just is, if we were all working from a common set of, okay, this is a sensible way to use this technology, which, by the way, is awesome and energizing. And as an entrepreneur, I use it every day. But if we were all on the same page about how to use it, I think some of the back and forth would go away. So I think it's very easy to not give people credit for, and I've seen this professionally a lot, it's easy to not give people credit for expertise because you're not an expert in it. So it may be easy to say, well, you know, and you think about all the funny statistics about people who think they can defeat a bear in a fight. You know, it's like 60%, you know, I could beat up a grizzly bear. You could not beat up a grizzly bear. You know, it's the same idea. You know, I could, you know, read that x-ray better than a trained radiologist. No, you could not. But there's just a kind of a thread of humility, because I think a certain fraction of the population, if they sort of don't know what they don't know, have that response of like, yeah, I got it. I know, you know, and then the rest of us are going, no, you don't have it. The bear's about to eat you.
I love the, maybe that's your next book. Maybe you'll make the guidelines there, right? Because you're right, AI was just kind of thrown out there. No instruction manual, just play with it. It kind of, you mentioned Gen X, I have to throw in this Gen X reference. There was a show in the early 80s called The Greatest American Hero, who just became a superhero, but he lost the manual. He lost the manual, so he didn't really know how to use his powers. And that's kind of like society and AI. So we've talked about knowledge. We've definitely talked about technology as part of our knowledge discussion, methods and people. So let's talk a little bit about methods for the effectiveness framework.
Methods, again, is an interesting one for me to write about, because this is the one I really stink at, right? This is my personal low point. You know, that kind of magic of how do I kind of just operationalize different parts of my work and put it all together? You know, I have a ton of respect for folks like that. And, you know, and I can think of, I've had a lot of colleagues over the years who describe themselves as, I'm a great operator. And I love that. I love that. It's something that we don't necessarily give people often full marks for, that, you know, we just see that things happen really well adjacent to an individual. And we don't realize all the conscious and subconscious things that person is doing to make them happen that way. You know, just simple things like what sequence things need to happen in, right? And how much time do you need to allot to particular things? Like there's a real both science and an art to that. And people who are strong at methods are just amazing at that. And, you know, we need to give them their flowers. We need to really recognize that that brings something special to the workplace. And again, there's all this energy of kind of like, well, you know, we don't need people to orchestrate this because AI is going to orchestrate it. And, you know, it misses some of the, again, kind of a real human gift there, that, you know, there, you might be able to use, let's say, a great algorithm to orchestrate a, you know, rideshare ride. But you notice the rideshare companies don't have algorithms, you know, running the entire business. They don't have algorithms on their board of directors. And there's a good reason for that, because at a certain level of complexity, humans who are great at methods are the right people to be doing the work.
This makes perfect sense to me. Let's talk about people.
People is a really cool one for me, because part of what sort of this meta point that I got really interested in is, you know, I interviewed a lot of people for this book. I interviewed kind of a few dozen folks. And I realized that a couple of the folks that I spoke to are not just good with the people side, but at kind of the next level of performance on the people side. So sort of an ordinary good level of performance on the people side is effectively, without being, you know, sort of manipulative or any of the kind of dark triad stuff, that when you need to accomplish things, you can get people to like help you do them. You can communicate clearly with people. You know, these things sound very like, Melissa, those are real workplace basics, but they're real workplace basics that a lot of us don't get right. You know, so it is very much like, can you get people on your side? Can you get them to help you? Can you speak to them clearly? Can you hear them clearly? You know, that's kind of good, ordinary. And then when you get to sort of the next level of this area of the effectiveness architecture, you become like this kind of super connector, that you look at people in such kind of beautiful, empathic and understanding depth that you are then able to like assemble networks of people. And you think, okay, I just met you, you know, Richard, you know, 5 minutes ago, and you're making me think of this person I met 7 years ago, and I should put you guys together. That connectivity is going to do something great for the two of you, and it's going to be good for the world. That fascinates me, that kind of next level of people effectiveness, where you really, really understand what makes individuals special and unique, and then you can do something with it. I mean, that to me is just incredibly cool.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. I'm loving this. So we've got this effectiveness framework, knowledge, methods, people, and technology all coming together in a very nice stew. Talk to us, Melissa, about the second half of this book.
Okay. So the second half, you know, so you're like, this is great. I'm going to go. I'm going to be effective. And then you're like, wait, why am I not effective yet? Okay. The second half of the book is about all the things that challenge our effectiveness. So work intensification, highly emotional workplaces, hyper-transparent workplaces. You know, we always think transparency is a good thing, and it is mostly, but the level of kind of information permeation around organizations at the current moment is also challenging in certain ways. And then finally, just chaos, pure chaos. You know, it's really hard to be effective in chaotic environments. And I talk about, you know, by the way, this is all nuanced by which piece of the architecture you're really good at. So for example, if you have, you know, kind of a strong capability around people, very emotional environments will actually wear you down, because you become the person whose office people cry in. And that could be metaphorical, obviously, right? Virtual world, you know, maybe you're the person they call up on Zoom and cry, or whatever it is.
The Zoom crier.
Yeah. I mean, look, we've all been there, both the crier and the cryee. But, you know, as a for instance, because people end up leaning harder on you as the person who's got these great people skills, you know, highly emotional environments will wear you down faster. Whereas if you're like the tech expert in a highly emotional workplace, be fine, you know? And so that's part of what's interesting, is saying that there's kind of this array of what people are good at, and the same situation may hit two people very differently. And we have to kind of allow for that and plan for that and give space for that. I think sometimes a mistake I've seen leaders make over and over is they process a situation through their particular lens. So, you know, they say, well, you know, okay, my strength is, you know, whatever it is, let's say, you know, methods, and we're operating in, you know, a hyper transparent environment. So it affects me in this exact way. So why doesn't it affect you in this way? And the answer is just, you know, different effectiveness sources of power have different interactions with these different challenges.
So let's go through these in a little more detail. Again, I feel like we've touched on the emotional one a bit, but workplace intensification. So talk to us about that.
This is a fascinating one to me, because this is where I sort of uncovered this one while doing research for my first book, and then really dug into it, including conducting some primary research myself for the second book for Effective. Work intensification is defined by the European Working Conditions Survey, which is one of those great big like workplace survey. You know, you can see I get really excited talking about this data out there that, you know, explores with large populations certain phenomenons. And they define it as three pieces. And one actually was enough to devote a separate chapter to, which is highly emotional workplaces are considered intensified because, right, if you're working and everybody's emotional around you and you're emotional, right, that does make work harder to perform. It just, your body feels it more. But the other two pieces are task overload. So literally just too many things to do, and excess interdependence. And excess interdependence is a really sneaky one because that creeps up on you and it's hard to measure, but it's really palpable. And that's basically when you have to, too many other people have to get involved for you to get any one thing done. So when Jamie Dimon had that great, you know, sort of town hall rant about 17 committees and why does it take 17 committees to, you know, approve an investment decision, that's what he was talking about. And it was a very telling cultural moment for me because that's a very powerful CEO of a very large company, and he still feels completely whacked by excess interdependence and the work intensification that comes from it. And that's a, you know, I don't know if that's a canary in the coal mine. That's like Big Bird in the coal mine. You know, that's a huge signal to me. So it's really, when I talk about work intensification in the book, it's those two things. It's the too many tasks and then the excess interdependence.
Can't help but think of Office Space and the whiteboard where they have the meeting and it says planning to plan, right? Too many tasks, yep. Too many things to do. So if you're the leader and your organization has excess interdependence and task overload, what do you do?
What do you do? Well, I think there's two kind of brute force weapons. So for task overload, you know, I'm going to say something pretty straightforward that most organizations are, especially these days, pretty horrible at. Prioritization. You have to be willing to say, okay, for this boat to, you know, stay in the water, these things are going to have to get thrown off the boat. And why that doesn't happen better is there's a sort of a political cost to it. Like, you know, I don't want to be seen as lazy because I said we could only do three out of the five things. And so with the part, some of it is just changing the conversation. You're strategic because you said we could do three out of the five things, not lazy. And the interesting thing about task overload, by the way, is it manifests, per our research last year, it manifests all the way up to the C-suite, that you've literally got people, CEOs, CFOs, whatever, saying they are overloaded with tasks. And again, if the CFO's overloaded, what does that mean for the rest of us, right? It's a bit disturbing. So prioritization is your weapon on task overload. Your weapon on excess interdependence is to actually set, you know, if you think about how we've constructed organizations over the last, let's 50 years, right? It's always been more collaboration, work better together, 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 together. Right. There's an efficient frontier of collaboration. Humans are, and I talk about this in the book, we're biologically designed to collaborate. That's why we have the white parts of our eyes, is so we can silently signal to another caveman during a hunt where the saber-toothed tiger is going, or the woolly mammoth, or whatever animal it is that you're hunting. So we're built to collaborate, but we're not built to collaborate this much. So the weapon there is to really say, what can I do to allow people to work more independently? And our research really showed that, you know, once people felt they could work more independently, they felt more effective. And conversely, people who had to involve a lot of people to get any given thing done felt a lot more ineffective and overwhelmed. But when you say, how can people work more independently? That's countercultural in many organizations. That's like, whoa, you know, you don't want people to be like lone wolves, which, by the way, is actually a myth about wolves. They're pretty social animals. They form tight packs. The lone wolf thing is cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs anyway. But if you can set that kind of countercultural goal and then say, we're going to enable true figure eight collaboration, right? Like, come together, go apart, come back together. That's, I think, where you start to cut down on some of this excess interdependence. But again, it's politically tough because sometimes it means saying, okay, Bob, you don't have a say in that decision because the number of people who have to touch that decision for things to happen is too many. So, okay, you know, this person over here has a say and you don't, and you're going to have to accept it. And I think some of the lack of courage on conversations like that, again, is how we ended up where we've ended up.
Makes sense. I've been waiting to talk about this one because nobody has ever brought this up as a topic ever with me on my show. Hyper transparent workplaces.
This one is so interesting to me because I truly believe, you know, sometimes there are trends that are just sneaky trends that are kind of like creeping up on you. I really think this one is creeping up on us. And it's the interesting thing is it's the function of a whole bunch of different things intersecting. So it's everything from like the invention of the group chat, you know, to the trend for data-driven workplaces, you know, to like greater open plan workplaces and everyone not being in offices anymore. All of these forces have kind of added up to these environments where a lot of information is floating around of possibly questionable nature, and everybody talks about everything and everyone else all the time. And that makes for an interesting environment. I think there were some unintended consequences here. I mean, I remember, I'm old enough to remember, you know, the rise of the data-driven workplace. But what we now see is there's a lot of data out there. It's not always of good quality, and people don't know what to do with it. There's kind of a lot of like, you can't handle the truth, you know, moments going out there. And so this is a really interesting one to grapple with as a leader, because quite simply, a lot of leaders are uncomfortable with the amount that people now sit around and talk about them. You know, with the, it used to be people had to physically gather by the water cooler and like whisper to each other. Now you can have 37 people in a group chat absolutely eviscerating every decision you've ever made. And that's a different dynamic to manage toward. And that's the hyper-transparent workplace of today.
And the last one, probably an apt descriptor for our world today, chaos.
Yeah. So I had the funniest experience writing this chapter because I hate chaos. Chaos drives me nutty. Like it's very triggering to me. And so I'm like, I'm going to like start by researching that, you know, and I'm already twitching the scientific definition of chaos. And so I go into this beautifully written blog that I cite in the book, and it opens with the sentence, "Chaos is the science of surprises." And I was like, first of all, you know, I was an English major. I'm like, that's a beautiful sentence. That's such a gorgeous sentence. And then I was like, and I really like the underlying idea behind it. And when you frame chaos that way, it's just this neutral thing. It's just all the ways that the world surprises us and is nonlinear and is unpredictable. And that's just the world. And, you know, so I'm like, okay, that's okay. I don't really mind that. So I then went on the psychological journey with myself about what is it I do mind. What I mind is the other kind of chaos, and it's people operating chaotically. And so the chapter talks about both. The chapter talks about all of the things, the ways that, how do you better prepare for all the ways the world is just going to surprise you? But also, what are your self-protective strategies when people are just kind of, you know, running things in a chaotic way? And that those are two different and distinct things. But it really represents a whole psychological journey for me to kind of get to that conclusion.
Was there anything that really surprised you as you were putting this book together and interviewing people and conducting your research?
Number one, one research finding that surprised me was some research actually connecting chaos to bad behavior. Because it was one of those things that sort of like intuitively we all kind of make that link like, yeah, you know, when it gets messy, people kind of act like jerks. But seeing it starkly on the page in a research-driven way that these researchers had statistically correlated chaotic environments to basically every form of workplace misbehavior, except for sexual harassment, which is apparently totally uncorrelated. So, okay, we'll put that to the side. But supervisory bullying, conflict between colleagues, and conflict with customers as well are all explicitly linked to chaotic environments. And that really gave me pause because, it, again, on my own psychological journey around chaos, I think sometimes part of what people are reacting to in chaotic environments is not the underlying chaotic factors themselves. It's how people are behaving, right? Under that umbrella of chaos is that people don't like the rough behaviors that then come out, and they're very right not to. But the other piece that I think was that really surprised me was sort of how much consensus there was among the interviews that some of these forces, particularly around transparency, are just a good impetus for us as leaders and the organizations that we work for to kind of get our act together. I had two different interviewees talk about the concept of coherence, that if things are weird behind the scenes and messy, then a world of social media and all of that is just going to kind of expose the messiness. But it's not about, oh, you shouldn't have written about that on Glassdoor. It's about fixing the underlying stuff. And so it was interesting to hear that come through in, you know, in multiple different interviews with people, very different vantage points.
It is interesting. It's something that I've talked about for years. It's just, there are these things we presume, but then when it's slapped on your face in a PDF with pie charts and bar graphs, it has a totally different connotation. Melissa, our time together has flown by, as I knew that it would. What a great conversation, just like the last one. As you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests just this one question, and that is, what is your biggest helping, that one most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our chat today?
I think that effectiveness, you know, can be simple but not easy, if that makes sense, that you don't need to be thinking about a million different things, but it is remarkably difficult to be effective in today's workplaces. And I want people to give themselves grace and space for that. I think that in and of itself, just kind of admitting we're at like a weird moment in working history goes through cycles, just admitting that we're in a weird moment and strategizing accordingly, I think it's a bit of an unlock.
Grace and space. I love that. What a great conversation. The book, Effective, How to Do Great Work in a Fast-Changing World. That's available everywhere tomorrow, and we'll have a link to that if people want to pre-order that and get their hands on it. But if somebody wants to learn more about you, Melissa, where can they go online to do that?
So they can connect with me on LinkedIn. You can check out anthromeinsight.com, and I am building a growing presence on Instagram as well.
A growing presence. Well, we will link to everything, Melissa Swift, in the show notes at drrichardschuster.com. Melissa, thanks for coming back. What a great chat. When your next book comes out, you're coming back again. We'll do it again.
Oh, amazing. Thank you for having me. This was so much fun, as always.
Absolutely. And thank you to each and every one of you who took time out of your day to listen to the conversation. If you're excited to grab this book, if you learned a lot today, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on the podcast app of your choice, because that is what helps other people find the show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post in your feeds using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.